Well, welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. And respect is absolutely what every veteran in our nation and all the families will get from the Progressive Radio Network and this radio show. We're going to continue to educate, inform, and do everything to help us. Well, today we're going to continue on discussing the horrible path of suicide and what happens with everybody. And joining Ray Clark today is Mandy Jo. Mandy Jo Goon, had her husband was in the Army and everything else, and things all went sour, and unfortunately, he made the ultimate choice. Mandy Jo, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you, Doug.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about your husband and just your story, wherever you want to go or however you want to go, please?
Okay. My husband, Aaron Gwynn, he was in the Army back in the Gulf War era, and he did not tell me about stories of different war stories, but eventually they came out once we were married. He then told me about a situation when he was in Kuwait. His friends had blown up, and he was there watching it. And there was another time when he had watched another friend die in his arms during training. During this time of us being married, he had several bouts of depression, anxiety, all different polytraumas that go with PTSD, and we had sought out help at the VA. He had been there for the last 5 or 6 years getting help. He has been through clinics, doctors, rehabs. He had trouble with addictions. And eventually, he thought that he had a disability claim filed for all of the struggles and troubles that he was going through with PTSD. He had also mentioned he had traumatic brain injury from being in Kuwait and other times from jumping out of airplanes. So after he passed, with May 9th, 2015, my husband took his life after struggling several years with different polytraumas from PTSD. He had sought medical advice from the VA, and unfortunately, he kept getting the same response, which was medication that did not help him. He struggled with sleeping. He struggled with noises. He struggled with all the things that were related to PTSD. And eventually, I think he couldn't handle the trouble. He couldn't handle the fight that was going on in his head. And one day, he talked to me about statistics from other military men that had been taking their lives. He told me about the 22 a day vets that commit suicide. I did not think anything of it. He was not the type of person to take his own life. He struggled with addiction, but he was not someone that I ever believed would have taken his life by his own hands. He loved his family. He loved me. He loved his children. And I just didn't foresee it to be something that would be in any realm of possibility for him. And the day that he took his life was the day after my birthday, one day before his birthday. And this also leads me to believe that he had no idea, the time frame. I've read more on research on suicide and believe that, you know, they don't think about things like that in the time that is happening. And Aaron eventually took his life by asphyxiation. And I found out about it because I was outside the home. Eventually, I had to tell my children, and that was really, really, really tough to try to explain that to two young children. I loved him more than anything. He loved life, and he loved his children and his family more than anything. So this was a complete shock. Suicide, I can't even explain how I feel about what has happened. After Aaron's passing, I began to do a little of my own research after trying to file claims with the VA. He has a lot of diagnoses that were acquired in the VA from, you know, his PTSD, and I thought that the VA would be there to help my family and I through the struggles that, you know, would come as the future arrives. And unfortunately, they have denied our claim and stating that Aaron's suicide did not relate to any of his time served. They also told me that any disability claim that it looked like Aaron thought that he filed, that nothing was there. I do not believe that my husband came home that day after filing papers and think that, you know, he made it up. It's definitely something that needs to be brought to attention, because I believe that my husband was waiting patiently to hear about his disability, to hear what next steps were supposed to be taken. And the VA dropped the ball and never contacted him, never let him know, even though after the disability claim, he was still going back to the VA clinics trying to get assistance. He was trying to get help. And unfortunately, they were still just giving him medication. They were not trying to assist him. They were not walking hand in hand with him. They were not assisting him with all the struggles and troubles that he had. Several times he was asked, you know, if he would take his life. And a few of those questions, even in the diagnosis papers, state that he said yes, or that he felt helpless or hopeless. And still he was released, you know, within the next day. I feel like they've dropped the ball on our claim, denying us any kind of help or assistance, because he believed he had disability. Also, I believe that my children, as his children, should have been supported in some way. They also denied his burial allowance. They're saying that all claims are denied because he was not service-related. But unfortunately, my husband did not realize that when he was alive. He did not realize that there was more to be done, or that somebody dropped the ball and didn't finish assisting him with whatever papers needed to be done. And so now, my children and I are trying to fight the VA to try to get the assistance that I believe that we should have. He wrote, you know, he signed that blank check years ago to help and to serve and to protect us. And now we're left high and dry. They've left us and we have nothing. And I just believe that the system is wrong for what's going on. And I'm going to try to fight and then eventually hopefully be an advocate for other people that are also fighting this fight. Statistically, I find that suicide is actually probably higher in the military than we actually know. I know that the statistics say 22 to 23 a day, but being that I am a wife of a suicide, I am a survivor. My husband has been deemed denied, so I wonder, and I'm very curious to find out the real statistics out there on suicide that are not even in the numbers, because he was denied as military related. How many other men are denied military related? So today I'm just out here speaking about where we can help other military men and women that are thinking about suicide and other families that are going through similar situations that I'm going through.
It's been a nightmare. I mean, when we look at all the problems through the years, the numbers from Vietnam that got sick from Agent Orange, and then we get to Desert Storm, the incredible numbers that are sick from all of the toxic exposures, We look at all the toxic exposures and all the health effects from Operation Iraqi Freedom and during Freedom, New Dawn, and whatever else they continue to do. And then when the veteran goes in for care, and I've experienced this myself, I mean, Ray, you've experienced this, I believe,
Yeah. They're
in denial that there's any correlation between what happened on the battlefield and the physiological effects affecting the body, and then the psychological effects. There's nobody wants to deal with it. Nobody wants to deal with the overall abandonment. I mean, from what I understand, and as you explain your story, and it's not new, the veteran felt like they were totally abandoned, and they had no place left to go, no choice, no options, no alternatives, because those people that they trusted and asked for help walked away. I mean, 1 year ago when we lost our co-host with this radio show, Paul Lyons, that's what he saw. He saw no more hope. He saw no more future. He saw no more, you know, promise that anybody was going to wake up and do anything. Ray, what do you think?
You know, Doug, when I hear this talking, and Amanda, first of all, my heart goes out to you and your family. I'm one of those guys, and I have played with suicide probably thousands of times over the last 46 years. I've ridden my motorcycle and spit in the wind just to spit in my face because I knew who I really was. I knew the things I'd done and the things I'd experienced. And nobody knew that but me, and I could not stand me. So I can understand the mindset of even your husband and all these other guys. And you feel like you'd rather be with your friends and your dead friends sometimes. But, you know, when the VA, they've done a lot of tremendous things for me, Doug. But one thing they did do that I don't have to, I mean, I don't agree with some of this stuff, is that their main way of dealing with suicidal tendencies is to put you on more drugs. They think if they would numb you, you're not feeling or pain, but you're just not feeling. And you began to lose more emotions, and you began to be more disconnected, and it creates more problems in the family. So the depression of losing your family and watching them slip away from you is part of the suicidal thing. And, you know, I've spoken with Amanda before, and I told her, I said, God understands the mind, and when you have become overcome with that depression, God does understand that, but he reaches out to you and uses people and everything else to reach out to you, trying to get you to not do that. And I've wished many times since I met Amanda that I wish I had been able to touch her husband. I believe, who knows, something we could have said, because I speak with Marines and sailors and different ones all the time. And I've had therapists to tell me they actually saw their faces change in the middle of what I tell them because it's like a light comes on. And these guys are losing hope. And they're losing a lot of things. And I sent you an email, and there's a scripture in the Bible in Luke 10, I think it is, but it talks about a man that was beaten up, robbed, and left for dead. And that's what is happening to these men and women and their families. And, Doug, we got to stop this thing somehow.
Mandy Jo, did they put your husband on psychotropic drugs or any of the Seroquel or any of these weird psychotropic drugs? Did you know?
Yes, they did. They put him on, I think there was 4 separate medications they put him on. He took him for a little while, especially after he came out of the clinics or rehab. But he did not want to continue taking those medications because he felt like his head was drowsy. He didn't feel like he was himself. He didn't feel like he could continue, you know, even thinking on his own. And unfortunately, he would continue to stop taking the medication because of that feeling that he was getting. It was supposed to help him sleep. It was supposed to help him feel better or, you know, stop the memories or help with the PTSD. But, you know, ultimately he would go to alcohol and he would numb it that way. And that always seemed to be his drug of choice. The only thing is whenever he'd get so drunk on alcohol, he would forget and then not even know where he was. And that he felt like was the only way to forget about whatever had happened. I had found him several times in our bathroom, you know, blood dripping from his face because he had jumped our back fence and went into our woods digging holes, thinking that he was finding or he was going to help save his friends. There was instances where we would be sleeping and helicopters would ride over and he would just start sweating and shaking in bed, you know, frantically. And I would have to wake him up. Of course, I was scared because I didn't know if he would do something to me, thinking maybe he was in the woods or something. But eventually I would wake him up and he wouldn't realize, you know, what was going on, but that he had had a dream, which I could only conclude that it started when the helicopter started coming over. He had night terrors and, I mean, it became bad on several occasions. And I felt like the medication wasn't helping. Even when he was on it, he was still having a hard time sleeping, or he wouldn't want to fall asleep. He would always say, I don't want to fall asleep. And so he would stay up real late or all night until eventually he would. But it was always a struggle back and forth being the same thing. And I really want to know how we can help other men, other veterans, other people that are going through the same thing and feel like nobody's there for them, because I know of several people and several organizations that I feel like I want to be there, but I don't know how to help get the word out, because I know when my husband was here, we didn't reach out to organizations because I thought the only place to get help was the VA. But now that he's passed, I have found several different nonprofits that actually are trying to reach out to veterans. And one of the organizations that I'm working with is VET, Veterans Entering Transition. And the co-founder, Angela Walter, is here with me. And she has been supporting me through all of this since I met her. And it's been an extraordinary trial, just getting to know people that actually want to help me and want to help my story and help other people. And so that's what I'd like to do, is help other people.
Were you and your husband married when he deployed over to the Middle East, or did you get married afterwards?
We got married afterwards. We met right after he came back. He did not seem to have any struggles at the beginning. It seemed like everything was fine, and he did not talk about anything. It took many, many years later for stories and the damage that was done to start coming out. He started expressing fear, survivor's guilt. Severe depression really started to kick in. He didn't want to be known as the one with post-traumatic stress, because of the stigma that went along with it. One of his big troubles was survivor's guilt. He told me a lot about, you know, being the last one left or being the one alive. He felt like his other soldiers should be here, and, you know, why is he still here? He struggled with that a lot.
Well, can I say something, Doug? I've got a website, Amanda, and it's theneverendingwar.com. It's under L.A.M. Clark, but it's I have a lot of information on there. And subtitles is about suicide. And I give seven or eight different reasons why, from a patient and from a suicidal person's perspective in the military, I put some of these things down. See if you can recognize it. One of the problems is shutting down after combat and facing a sudden lack of excitement. It brings loneliness, depression, and isolation. Survivor's guilt, depression, and a desire to be with your dead friends. Making bad choices with negative friends afterwards and entertainment. Watching different things. Substance use and abuse. And then undeserved recognition. People calling you hero and you're not a hero. You don't feel like you're a hero. We always said our heroes are dead, and there's a couple other things here. But all of it adds up to a person who is just lonely and feels abandoned, and he just goes in seclusion, and he just doesn't want anybody touching them or feeling them or in those things. And all these drugs, these psychotropic drugs, are just causing people to be, you know, disassociated with people. They had me on 8 hydrocodone a day. They had me on morphine. They had me on Zoloft. And they had me on some other Seroquel all at the same time. And by God's grace, I was able to get off all that stuff. And I'm off of it today. I had to do it, and I had to go to the VA, talk to a psychiatrist, talk to my doctors, and say, get me off of this stuff. And they put me on less drugs, and they also were able to wean me off of all these. So there are positive things you can do when you're under this spell, kind of, but you have to be proactive, and you have to want to get off. And the family can actually maybe even push the VA even harder.
You know, the problem we run into too often, we've heard this over and over again, and we've all faced this, and Ray, you and I have been helping people, and Amanda, you're just, what your whole thing is, the VA will know what's happening, or the vet goes in and says what's happening to something. But then the VA doesn't communicate that back with the spouse. You know, for whatever reason it is, and then they don't put the warning out. We've had way too many where the vet went into the VA and said, I'm thinking about doing it, and nobody did anything. Nobody said it. They just let them go home, and the next thing we know, they, you know, made that ultimate choice. I think from Dr. Bart Billings, Colonel Bart Billings, he's been on this radio show before. He's got an incredible book out there, and I'm reading it right now. He's talked about it on this radio program a couple weeks ago. And there's ways and there's treatment to deal with all this stuff without giving all these incredible psychotropic drugs, because the thing that scares me and frightens me is the individual that's come back from war, and we've all been there. Alcohol is the primary choice because it's available and everything. So you're going to use the alcohol to, as you said, Tammy, to numb yourself so that you don't feel it anymore. And then when you start combining that with the psychotropic drugs, and then you combine that with the pain medication that all of us have to live on to go on day from day as the weather changes or something else happens, you got a poison cocktail for which there's no end. And then
yes, true.
Your story, when you came out again, the abandonment that he just got. I mean, you know, I'm going for your help. You're supposed to help me. I put my paperwork in. Well, we've heard repeatedly all across this nation for years where the paperwork was submitted and the paperwork disappeared. I mean, Ray, you're aware, and Mandy, you might not know, but again, here just a few weeks ago, when I tried to get enrolled, and it's been over a year, in the Airborne Hazards Registry Program, the VA headquarters was saying they hadn't had no evidence I was in the Army or that ever deployed. What is a warrior going to do on that? What is an individual that doesn't have the backup, doesn't have a support network? How are they supposed to survive? I mean, I know why Paul chose suicide.
One of the things I did, Doug, it had nothing to do with suicide, but I had drank hard for 10 years, and I had done drugs too. But I worked. I worked 2 and 3 jobs sometimes trying to make one good paycheck. And a lot of friends I was at work with, we'd go get drinking after work, and we'd all go back home. But the only thing we had in common was the alcohol. And I was using it, I didn't realize it, but it was, trying to, like a coping skill, more or less, of trying to sedate myself, trying to live with me and my memories. But I was sitting in a bar one night with a lot of my friends I worked at work. And I got a beer, and I was sitting there at the bar drinking it. And I got to looking at the people I was hanging around. None of them were veterans. None of them, they liked camouflage, but they didn't like to, you know, go to the military. But I got looking at them, and I thought, what am I doing? I am losing everything I love over this. I put my beer down, and I said, I'm done. And I walked out, Doug, and I never drank another drop. That's been over 35 years ago. I made a conscious decision that I'm going to get better. Regardless of the VA. I didn't go to the VA then. But I had to make a decision that what I'm doing is not working. And if I want to spend my life with my wife or husband, whatever it is, and I want to be able to raise my children, then I have to do something about it. And I think it starts out with one conscious decision. I need to get better. And I've told you before, a few months later, I was invited to go to a church. I think I was just getting sober to do it so I could think. But that night, I did give my heart to the Lord. And when I got my heart right, I began to get my head right. And it's been kind of an uphill thing since then. But now it's turned into a pretty good journey. So it starts with a conscious decision, first of all.
Mandy, was your husband in contact with any of his former buddies or the guys he went to war with or anybody?
No, he was not. He did not keep in contact with any of them. So I have never met anybody. That is another problem that we're running into trying to prove the case of his PTSD to the VA. Like you said, Doug, loss of paperwork. I feel like they have lost his paperwork. And how am I to know that they truly have any of the records from when he was overseas, if they've lost his disability or, just like you, have lost all information on you being in the military? I find that to be a huge problem, especially going forward with my case and without my husband here. It even makes it harder to prove any of that. So right now I'm working with the VSO to locate all the information if possible. And also I'm working with VET is helping me out with all of that, with contacts and trying to work on my case. I also want to say that VET also tries a different approach with veterans. They use a more holistic approach to heal the veterans. They do different things like acupuncture, massage, yoga, and peer-to-peer counseling. And I think that's a better approach than filling their heads with medication like my husband was, because he did not like that. And I think working with organizations that are more able to work hand-in-hand with them is something that's going to help them succeed and transition back into their life, their families, and ultimately the community, so that they can work together on a more easy level instead of just throwing them out there and telling them, forget about what they saw, forget about what they've done. So I'm hoping to work with more families.
The veteran can't forget what they saw. The veteran can't forget what they did.
Exactly.
I mean, we have to make a decision, and now we've talked about this, all of us that have been through this and talked to the other ones that have, you know, chose the end. Too often, they wanted them to accept it as if, well, it was hunky-dory and everything was perfect. When the veteran, deep down in their soul, and this goes to the moral injury part of it, all this, which is really, I think, the underlying whole cause, is the veterans got a war within themselves, a war within their heart, a war within their soul, a war within their mind, where they're supposed to just suck it up and accept it, and yet they know it was wrong. And then when they're sick, I mean, what kind of medical problems was your husband exhibiting? I mean, we got the whole huge list of medical problems that are, you know, specifically identified from over there in the Gulf. You know, I mean, they're identified in all the documents, even though they're not made readily available to the veteran or the family members. They're there. What kind of physiological medical problems did he have as a result of his military duties?
Most of it, to me, living with it was the addiction part. He struggled, he had some hearing loss from over there, so he struggled with that, but majority of it was obviously, was the survivor's guilt, him just continually feeling like he was at a loss because he was still here. I think he struggled with just being alive after that. And day to day, it was a struggle for him. It was several times hard for him to keep jobs and working, you know, towards a better future. He felt a lot of times that for whatever happened overseas, that God would not accept him for who he was. And eventually, you know, we went to church and he saw a different side, but he struggled a lot with understanding that God would still love him after possibly, you know, killing people or hurting people or seeing what he saw. And that was one of his big struggles, and just believing that God could forgive the missions that he had.
Doug, when I came, well, before I did become a Christian, I remember I'd be out drinking during the night, and then I'd come back in home maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, and my wife would be there asleep, and my two little boys would be in their bedrooms. And I remember I used to go in their bedroom to get down by their bed, and I'd say, Lord, I know I'm going to go to hell, and I deserve it, but please don't let my babies go to hell. And I always said, you know, God might not have heard me, but he sure saw me. And I think what she just said, you feel like, who could love me? How could they love me knowing what I am? And it just drives you further away. One night I was on drugs, and suddenly I began to, and it was marijuana. A guy gave me some, wanted me to try it for him. So I said, free dope? Yeah, I'll do it. So I did some, and I began to hallucinate. And all of my dead friends came back to me that night. They were like 2 feet from me, and they never said anything. They just looked at me. And I was weeping and just crying. And there was a friend that walked me around for about an hour or two and got me to where I wasn't going to kill myself. But they wanted me to go with them, and I wanted to go with them. I wanted to be with them more than my own family. And, you know, I understand now what it was. It was hallucination. It was PCP that had been mixed with the marijuana that really did it, chemicals. But it also had a warm, fuzzy feeling to it. And I remember for years I kept feeling that warm, fuzzy feeling of seeing those guys again. And it was a draw to suicide. But I was able to overcome it. And I'm sure there were things like that working in his life of, you know, just trying to be with people. You know, when you think about those young guys, Doug, they don't make mistakes. They don't have problems. They don't argue. They're dead, really. But you immortalize them sometimes, and that's what we do with people who die. It's probably a false representation, too. But that's what you feel like. You just want to go to sleep, and you want it to stop hurting. And I'm so sorry.
Yes, I believe that's what my husband wanted to do. He definitely wanted to go to sleep, and he wanted it all to stop, everything that he was fighting in his head. I think it was a huge struggle. And eventually he decided with his own hands that he wanted that to stop.
Ray,
well, I mean,
you've talked about it in your book.
So I didn't do it. I just want to go to sleep, really.
Ray, you've talked about it in your book, and you've written about it, and we've talked about it before. Would you care to relate what happened on the ridge?
Up on the ridge?
Yeah.
There were 48 Marines and corpsmen, and on one ambush, we lost 42 of them dead, wounded. And your entire family went away. There were six of us left, and I was a senior man. I was a lance corporal. And I took over the platoon that day. And you lose your entire family. But that was a whole year of just constantly living in enemy territory and being, you know, just pummeled by the North Vietnamese. And, you know, today, Doug, with the media the way it is, cell phones and Skype and everything else, you're not away from your family, which has good and bad ramifications, because you're never away from the news, you're never away from protest, you're never away from a lot of things. And so I'm sure it works on these guys today. They realize that they're being palmed and they're over there doing things, and there's really no benefit to it. There was a word that was predominantly that we used it. I'm sure you used it too, and the word was wasted. We used to talk about, you know, being wasted or wasting somebody or your friends got wasted, and that's a pretty good word to describe what you feel, because it was seemed to be for nothing. We were coming home to a country that really didn't appreciate us, and today you come home and you feel like you've been wasted. You've been beaten up. You've been robbed of your people. And like Amanda just said, we got to reach out to these families because we have the answer. We live long enough, Doug. We've got some answers to this problem. And if we don't share it with them, we're losing the whole thing.
That doesn't mean we don't have problems. I mean, I think right now what I'd like to do, and I know this hurts and it hurts all of us, but when Paul made the decision to finally commit suicide, he sent an email to me right before he chose it. And I want to read this again because it's very clear. This is from Paul Lyons, Staff Sergeant, U.S. Army, retired from the 101st Airborne. I've had the privilege of co-hosting with Doug Rock and Denise Nichols on Gary Knows Radio Station, Progressive Radio Network on Warrior Connection, not in New York City, regarding the various exposures that occurred during Desert Storm, whether they be concerning depleted uranium, biological warfare, chemical exposures, not to mention experimental shots with records of them being given, as well as nerve agent pretreatment pills that we ordered to take that occurred during Operation Desert Storm. I am well over 275,000 troops are said to be on the Gulf War Registry. I've also been exposed. I have two post-Gulf War children who are also sick, including my wife. How's that for a welcome home party? The VA and DOD need to restart their children's spouse health registry and get with the program. We didn't ask for this, and I damn sure wouldn't have intentionally exposed my wife and now my sick post-war Gulf War children had I known that the birth defects and illnesses were transmittable. This has been a nightmare for my wife and I. Someone in the federal government needs to pick up the drop ball and get with the program. We also need congressional hearings for somebody in Congress with the backbone and fortitude of former U.S. Senator Donald Regal, who saw the problem back in the early 1990s and held hearings trying to get to the truth of Gulf War illnesses. And now we have OIF exposures as well. This government needs to settle this most important issue once and for all. If our current CBRN, also known as NBC Gear, is faulty, let's fix the problem. We know our gaps, so let's fix it. And within days, he, last conversation we had, he told me personally that he had no hope, no future, no dreams. He couldn't get a wheelchair ramp put in, installed, and he ended it. The day after day, night after night, all we hear is the abandonment that's gone on by the military and by the VA of the warrior and of the family member. And I mean, Mandy, what you're just saying, I mean, you have suffered the absolute total abandonment by them. I mean, total denial that your husband was there, he did the work, and the paperwork was submitted, and now you guys are left out in the cold. My heart just wants to scream.
Yes, Doug, that's exactly how I feel. I also feel that Aaron, he felt similar. He said he was, you know, he left a small note and he apologized for being so weak. And I never saw weakness in, from my eyes when I looked upon him. I think he felt alone and abandoned by the people he believed in. The VA, he felt, was there, and they weren't. As much as, you know, he would come home and tell me, just be patient, they're very backed up. He would say he had talked to somebody at the clinic, you know, about the process, and they told him to not check on his disability because his file would be pulled out and put back to the top, and he'd have to wait just that much longer. And so he would always tell me every time he'd come home from the clinic that I would bug him. Did you check? How's it looking? What's the next step? And he would say, just be patient. You know, they're not going to let us down. It's going to take a while. But what I think he didn't know, and we would not realize until after he died, was that there was nothing there, and they weren't assisting him. And every time he went into the hospital, he would see somebody new. He didn't see the same doctor. You know, nobody knew him. And it was very hard for me, you know, to not get involved, because he would say can handle it, or he has it. But they did not reach out to me, you know, as a family member. I was called one time when he was in rehab, just to refer back to, you know, any of his problems or his addictions or any kind of other struggles that he would have that maybe he wasn't telling them. But they didn't reach out to work together to do any kind of counseling with us. It was kind of, you know, if you don't reach out, then you don't really need the help. When truly inside all of his diagnosis papers and his medical records clearly would show all the troubles that he was going through. And I think it's sad to say that not only I am let down, my family and I, and I know my husband would feel very let down, but it's happening all across our country. And I just want to know how we can help or what next we can do to fix this type of system, because these men are fighting for our freedom. And in this country, you know, we get to be free. In many other countries, we don't. And that's one reason why my husband believed in the VA system, because he knew that, or he believed that they would back us up. And it saddens me today to know where I am now and what I'm fighting for my children and how I have to fight to get them any kind of help. And it's just, it's really saddens me.
You're the caregiver. I mean, there's all discussions, and I know I'm involved and was involved in the research project where they're looking at how do they alleviate the stress on the caregiver. And they're talking about mindfulness and all the other things that you said. I mean, yoga and all the stuff. So that's great. I mean, that stuff is absolutely essential, totally essential, and it works. But at the same time, the vet is in trouble. They can't get their proper medical care. The caregiver, as you just said, is trying to coordinate the medical care and make sure that their spouse or other half gets good medical care and understand what's happening. And there's no communication. And there's no support. So, I mean, you can make a person, to me, you can make a person feel good. You know, go out there and sit in the woods or walk through the woods. Yeah, I mean, I do it all the time, and it's essential. But when the individual is striving to get medical care, proper and optimal medical care, and they can't get it, and then you as the caregiver, I mean, this is what you just described, no matter what you did, you couldn't get it to happen. I mean, this is just a recipe for a disaster beyond all comprehension, and now your case is perfect example. I mean, it's a perfect example of a total abandonment by those that he trusted.
Doug, the other aspect, you and I talked about this many times, and I heard it in what she was saying, was that the moral injury part of it, where you feel dirty, you feel like what you've done was too bad for even God to forgive and things like that. And that has to do with the conscience. When your conscience has been violated, either by somebody doing something to you or something doing something to you or you doing something that violates that conscience, that those six laws of the Ten Commandments that God put inside of us when we were born, don't lie, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't kill, don't unjustifiably, and don't be greedy and treat your parents. Well, a lot of those things happen in war. And so you come back and you feel that bad conscience. One thing I have to make sure these guys understand is God is your friend. He's not your enemy. And God is not a crutch for weak people. He's actually a stretcher for the wounded and the dying, because he's carried us when we couldn't go any further. And the other thing is you cannot focus on a rearview mirror. You have to look down the road if you drive a car. You have to look at the horizon, not what happened, but what can happen. And even though your past is messed up, you have a bright future. Start today, draw a line in the sand, and start moving forward to a better and make better choices and all these things we talked about. The only difference between me and the people I admire are the choices I make. And you begin to move forward with your family, and I promise you'll have a good future. If you don't, you'll probably die right where you are, because you'll never move forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's essential, and And this is what we hope for. All these other kids, they come back that, you know, they realize that they've got an opportunity. They're going to go out and get an education. They're going to learn a trade, get an academic skill, get a good job, they do it, get some medical care. And then, as you said, make the choice and move forward because, you know, I mean, we have all survived, and now we can thrive.
That's right.
That abandonment, and again, Tammy, you've just explained it totally. I mean, your husband felt completely and thoroughly abandoned with no more hope or any dreams or anything left at all. And we've heard this. This is what Paul described. This is what we hear day upon day after day.
Yeah. Amanda has every reason to sit down and just die where she is. But then again, she's got some children. She's got a future. And she told me she's going to school, she's working, she's doing progressive things, and she begins to move forward. That's the choices she makes, and that's how she's going to get a better future. If she holds God's hand and she will walk forward and do what she feels like she needs to do and being led to do, there's no telling what kind of future she has. You just cannot allow your past to control your future. I know it's bad things hurt, but your children are going to need you, and that moral injury translates into your life, Amanda, and to your children. And you have to make sure they're not living in the past either. You have to move them forward. And you maybe you do it in recognition of him, of trying to live better for him. And you find a lot of good reasons.
A Cherokee shaman.
Yes, I believe that God is definitely leading me on a different path. The struggle has definitely led me to a much deeper passion about the military. And you're right, Ray, I am going to school, and I am pursuing more education so that I can help other families that are in similar positions as I am, because they are not alleviating any of my pain. This should be a grieving season for me, but instead I am not only grieving, taking care of my children, working two jobs, going to school, I am also fighting the VA to get what I believe that my family and most importantly my children deserve. And so it's not going to be easy, but I feel that with God in my life, I can do that. And I think that he's gotten me to where I am today. And my husband also, he loved God. And from what the investigator told me, he died next to his Bible and a family of his, in the picture of his family. And I believe that eventually, someday, we'll all see each other. But this path is taking
We talk about the
somewhere
future
different than I expected, but...
We talk
Go
about
ahead,
the
Doug.
Future. Yeah, we talk about the future and moving on, and Cherokee Shaman sent this to me some time ago when I was having struggles, and Ray and I, we've used this before, and I'm going to just read this because it makes a lot of sense, and the author is unknown. I got it from a Cherokee shaman. It's called My Quilt. As I faced my maker at the last judgment, I knelt before the Lord along with all the other souls. Before each of us laid out our lives, squares of a quilt in many piles. An angel sat before each of us, sewing our quilt squares together into a tapestry that is our life. But as my angel took each piece of cloth off my pile, I noticed how ragged and empty each of the squares were. They were filled with giant holes. Each square was labeled with a part of my life that had been difficult, the challenges and temptations I was faced with in everyday life. I saw hardships that I endured, which were the largest holes of all. I glanced around me. Nobody else had such squares other than a tiny hole here or there, and other tapestries were filled with rich color and bright hues of worldly fortune. I gazed upon my own life and was disheartened. My angel was sewing ragged pieces of cloth together, threadbare and empty, like binding air. Finally, the time came when each life was to be displayed, held up to the light, the scrutiny of truth. The others rose, each in turn, holding up their tapestries. So filled their lives had been, my angel looked upon me and nodded for me to rise. My gaze dropped to the ground in shame. I hadn't had all the earthly fortunes. I had love in my life and laughter, but there also have also been trials of illness and death, false accusations that took from me from my world as I knew it. I had to start over many times, often struggle with temptation, to quit only to somehow muster the strength to pick up and begin again. I spent many nights on my knees in prayer asking for help and guidance in my life. I had often been held up to ridicule, which I endured painfully each time offering up to the Father in his hopes that it would not melt within my skin beneath the judgment gaze of those who unfairly judged me. And now I had to face the truth. My life is what it was, and I had to accept it for what it was. I rose and I slowly lifted the combined squares of my life to the light. An awful gas filled this air. I gazed around at the others who stared at me with wide-open eyes. Then I looked through upon the tapestry before me. Light flooded the many holes, creating the image of the face of Christ. Then our Lord stood before me with a warmth and a love in his eyes, and he said, "Every time you gave over your life to me, it became my life, my hardships, my struggles. Each point of light in your life is when you stepped aside to let me shine through until there was more of me than there was of you. May all your quilts be threadbare and worn, allowing Christ to shine through." And sure, that was someone you love. I mean, there's a hope and a dream in that, wherever it came from. And it seems like with all the stuff, the horrors we live through and everything that we've got to go and what we see, that, as you said, there's a new door that's open. I mean, Tammy, you've had a horrible, horrible thing happen. An entire room, an entire house has been shut down. When that's explained, maybe a door or window is opened.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, I would encourage Amanda what she said earlier about moving on. But, you know, you can either be one of the crowd or you can be a standard bearer. And what you do is, I tell veterans all the time and their families and different ones, don't just go up and shake a veteran's hand and say, "Thank you for serving." That is good, and they need that. But try to have something tangible to give them. Get some information. You go on my website, and you can get a lot of information about not only suicide, but how to curb it and what to tell them and different information. Put things in their hands that's going to, they can get home and read it and think about it and maybe reconsider some things. I've realized, Doug, with a few words, you can radicalize someone, make them mad as fire. Or with a few good words, you can de-radicalize them. You can calm them down. The Bible said a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. If you had something in your hand to give, put in their hand, that they could maybe get a grip and maybe start to move forward into a new life. And I've had young Marines tell me, I've never heard anybody tell me that before. And what we have to do is find out the right things to give these folks and then give it to them. And let them read it or let them look at it or whatever you can, Amanda, however you do your program. But get them moving forward in life. That's what it is. And even move them toward God. Let them know that he is not their enemy. He is their friend. He loves them. And so I appreciate what you're doing, Amanda.
Thank you. I'm trying, and I want to put the word out there, and I want to be an advocate for other people. At the same time, I'm also working with other organizations to help me get through this. I'd definitely like to plug in VET that I spoke about earlier that has helped me through much of this. They are having their first gala in Raleigh, North Carolina. You can visit them at www.myusvet.org. I will be speaking there, giving my first testimony there. And it's just an organization that I really believe in, the transition period of military coming back into community and families. And they have been here to help me in so many ways that I definitely want to give back to the community just as they have given to me.
What kind of advice can you offer another spouse that's facing these problems from what you've learned? What can you offer or suggest to them? I mean, you know, we can talk about it, but until we're there, we don't know. And it's a very difficult question, but if you can, please.
I would say one thing is walk beside them. You know, I thought I was there all the time, and I tried during all the episodes of his addiction. But ultimately, when it came down to it, I couldn't tell the difference from the addiction and not really understanding suicide. I think that when he started speaking about the statistics, I should have probably been looking into it. I didn't ever think that it would be something that would truly cross his mind. And I didn't think until afterwards what a difference he was those last couple weeks before he took his life, and how hopeless he was in life. And I think it's something that we need to bring awareness to, is to prevent suicide, is just to recognize the differences, the stuff that they talk about, the way that they walk, the way they hold their head. I just felt there was something different about him. But of course, at the time, I couldn't pinpoint it until afterwards, and then it's too late. So if you start to notice something or some change or the way they talk, I would really talk about it. I would go speak with somebody. I would try to get counseling, help, anything to maybe get them to open up about how they really are feeling, because I had no idea that it was actually something that he was even thinking about. So I would definitely tell another spouse to, you know, just try to walk with them hand in hand, even if it's walking into the hospital, or if it's walking into a counseling office or walking to one of their buddies. It's something that needs to be talked about, and it's something that I should have talked about more once he started talking about suicide. I should have recognized that, and that's something I didn't.
It's very difficult. I mean, I know, you know, Bob McDonald, if you're listening to this, you're a secretary of the VA, any of the presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton, all you guys, I mean, you guys have been there. God, all Bernie Sanders has been here for all of the vets forever and ever. He's been a leader in that. You know, when we got Don Trump, all these guys now, then the Senator Cruz. I mean, if you're listening or hear us, please, you got to jump in and help us. You got to help the families, the spouses, and everything. I mean, I'm appealing to you to help. And I think we have to make an appeal to everybody in the nation that listens to actually take a stand and demand that everybody's taken care of without any more hesitation or debate or arguments. Why should the vet have to go in there and argue with the VA doctor about medical care? Why do they have to go in and argue about getting proper treatment or getting the benefits that they earn defending our nation? I mean, I just can't understand that.
Well, you know, Doug,
I completely agree, Doug. I hope that this brings awareness to all the government officials out there that are running or are already in, because this is something that needs to be taken care of.
Ray, I mean, you've got your book out there. Tell people how they can get a hold of their book, your book, and your website, please.
Okay, the book is called The Never-Ending War, Unseen Scars of Post-Traumatic Stress, and it's listed under L. M. Clark, although it is a story about me, Ray Clark. It's in my words. My wife and I co-wrote this book, and there's stories about being a wife of a husband with post-traumatic stress, and the stress that's on the family. And, you know, even though I became a Christian somewhere along the way, I still had to deal with the memories and the nightmares and things like that. So, and then with the VA. But you can find that at Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and Amazon and different places. And, you know, I think the book has done some tremendous work, Doug, because I get a lot of feedback on that book and a lot of opportunities. And it's about trauma, but it's about what trauma does to the human spirit and then the treatment for it. The VA did a lot of great things. They, you know, they gave me therapy and medication in the right amount. That's good. But I'll tell you, Doug, only God gave me peace and forgiveness, and I needed that because as long as you're carrying that guilt around, it will really cause you a lot of problems. And so, and I tell them a lot of times, go to church. Take your family to church. The best home improvement you can do is take your family to church. And then I tell them why. is some of the best people in town go there. You need to hang around better people with less, you know, substance abuse and all these other problems. And you need to get some good teaching for you and your family, your children, about morals and you know, how to go through this life and have the best life. And it's just a good place to hang around. They have good food. Everybody smells good, usually. It's just a lot of good reasons. So figure out the best thing for you and your family and the best places to take them and be a family. And I promise you, your life will begin to flower and begin to bloom. And you begin to move on.
I think as all these care people around that are doing research and trying to develop care, they've just got to look at the hardcore of what's happening and face the reality that all this stuff is based on abandonment and based on the fact that the individual there has lost all hope and all dreams. And as a man, as you said, your husband struggled with, does God love me or does anybody love me anymore for what he saw and what he endured and what he experienced? I mean, that I think that's an eternal problem for all the military going back to antiquity.
I agree, Doug. I definitely think that that's something that they shouldn't have to struggle with. And ultimately, you know, if they are to seek out God or any higher power, then I think that's something that might help them.
Well, we've reached an end of a show. I'd like to thank you, Mandy. We're here to help you get the information out. Anybody in the government that listens to the VA, we've got another widow, another spouse, another nightmare program, and we've got to fix it. Let's do it. Thank you. God bless America. Thank you, Ray. Thank you, Mandy. Take care.
Thank you.